Speaking on this program is Brother Winford Claiborne.
Thank you and good morning. In the late 1940s and the early 1950s, I taught high school English at Benton, Kentucky. Our freshman English text was entitled Adventure and included a story about gambling. The story, The Celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County, was written by Mark Twain and was always a favorite of most high school freshmen. Mark Twain's story includes the following paragraph, which is a classic description of a compulsive gambler. There was a fellow here once by the name of Jim Smiley in the winter of 49, or perhaps it was the spring of 50. I don't recollect exactly somehow. Though what makes me think it was one or the other is because I remember the big flume wasn't finished when he first came to the camp. But anyway, he was the curiousest man about always betting on anything that turned up you ever see. If he could get anybody to be on the other side, and if he couldn't, he'd change sides. Any way that suited the other man would suit him. Any way, just so he'd got a bet, he was satisfied. But still, he was lucky, uncommon lucky. He most always come out a winner. He was always ready and laying for a chance. There couldn't be no solitary thing mentioned, but that fellow'd offer to bet on it, and take any side you please, as I was telling you. If there was a horse race, you'd find him flush or you'd find him busted at the end of it. If there was a dog fight, he'd bet on it. If there was a chicken fight, he'd bet on it. Why, if there was two birds sitting on a fence, he would bet you which one would fly first. Or if there was a camp meeting, he would be there regular to bet on Parson Walker, which he judged to be the best exhorter about there. And so he was, too, and a good man. Even if he seen a straddlebug start to go somewheres, he would bet you how long it would take him to get wherever he was going to. And if you took him up, he would follow that straddlebug to Mexico, but what he would find out where he was bound for and how long he was on the road. There is much more to Mark Twain's story, but you get the drift of Jim Smiley's penchant for gambling. While Mark Twain's story was intended to be humorous, and it is, gambling is not humorous. It is a deadly serious business. I use the word deadly advisedly, because lives, homes, and communities are destroyed by gambling. Two books, which I shall be using in our studies of gambling, indicate the deadly nature of this great evil. Ross Coggins edited a book for Broadman Press in 1966, which he called The Gambling Menace. In 1985, Dr. Larry Braidfoot wrote a book for Broadman, which has the title, Gambling, A Deadly Game. Are the titles of these books exaggerating the evil effects of gambling? If you listen carefully to our lessons on gambling, you will be able to make up your minds with regard to that question. I have chosen to speak on gambling at this particular time for a number of reasons. It is always appropriate to discuss any theme that touches on so many lives. Hundreds of thousands of men, women, and children gamble almost as regularly as they eat and sleep. Virtually every community in the United States and abroad has some form of gambling. Businesses are ruined. Homes are broken. Churches are disgraced. And individual lives are shattered because somebody spends too much money on games of chance. There is a very strong possibility that legislation to legalize some form of gambling will be introduced into the Tennessee General Assembly in 1987. In addition, plans for a racetrack and for parimutuel betting are being arranged for southeast Missouri. I am deeply concerned about what gambling will do to our area and to the lives of the individuals who may be lured into this great evil. I am presenting these lessons on the evils of gambling to educate our citizens and to encourage each of us to use his influence with his local, state, and federal officials to destroy this great evil from the very face of the earth. I urge you to listen carefully and to join me in this fight against gambling. A few minutes ago, I mentioned Larry Braidfoot's new book, Gambling, A Deadly Game. In my judgment, this is by far the finest book on gambling I have ever read. Dr. Braidfoot is General Counsel and Director of Christian Citizenship Development for the Christian Life Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention. He also edits materials and periodicals on Christian social and spiritual issues. Dr. Braidfoot earned his law degree from the University of Texas and holds a Ph.D. degree in Christian ethics from Baylor University. He is well prepared academically for his task and has spent hundreds of hours in various legislative hearings and in courts of law as an expert witness against gambling. I urge you to buy the book and to read it carefully. After you have read it, let your neighbors and family members read it. Better yet, buy several copies and send them to your local, state, and national representatives. Give a copy also to your local preacher and ask him to deliver some scriptural lessons on gambling. We cannot afford to be ignorant on the subject, nor can we afford to be apathetic. But what is gambling? Are not insurance, stocks and bonds, grain and cotton futures, and farming gambling? Is not life itself a gamble? These are legitimate questions, and I plan to answer them in the course of our studies on gambling. Henley Barnett taught Christian ethics at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville for many years. Dr. Barnett joined with about 250 other scholars to produce Baker's Dictionary on Christian Ethics. Dr. Barnett defines gambling as follows. Gambling involves the transfer of something of value from one person to another on the basis of mere chance. Three basic factors appear in the process of gambling: the payoff, the element of pure chance, and the agreement to pay by the bettors. Page 257. Let us analyze briefly the three basic factors involved in gambling. First, Dr. Barnett mentions the payoff. If there is no payoff, there is no gambling. For example, when we were youngsters, we used to say, "I'll bet I can beat you to the house." We would then take off and run as fast as our legs would carry us. While the word bet has a gambling connotation, and our parents discouraged our using that kind of language, we were not gambling. We did not wager any money or any other items that were of any material worth. Pride and prestige may have been involved, but there was no payoff. On the other hand, if we had bet a quarter on our running skills, that would have been gambling. If our parents had learned of our betting on a race or on any other activity, such as playing marbles for keeps or pitching horseshoes, we would have been in big trouble. Our parents taught us that playing cards for a penny a point or playing marbles for keeps was just as much gambling as betting on the horses. There was no difference in kind, just a difference in degree. Second, Dr. Barnett's definition speaks of the transfer of something of value on the basis of mere chance. If you need a new automobile, and you go down to your local dealer and pay him $10,000 for a new car, a transfer of something of value has been made, but it was not made on the basis of mere chance. Obviously, some chance is involved, but it is not mere chance. I had a friend in Georgia who bought a new station wagon. On the way home, the front window of the automobile fell out on the driver's side. Of course, the company made it good, but the buyer had taken a chance. There is no law that would define what my friend did as gambling. The third element in gambling, according to Dr. Henley Barnett, is the agreement to pay by the bettors. If nobody agrees to pay when losses occur, then whatever is involved does not constitute gambling. Losses of various kinds happen in sporting activities, such as football games, golf, tennis, but where nobody agrees to pay off in the case of loss, then gambling does not occur. But everybody gambles, the apologists for gambling assert. I will certainly concede that gambling has a long and bloody history among human beings. Of course, gambling does not take place among the animals. In fact, I heard what I consider a great definition of horse sense. It is that rare quality found among horses that prevents their betting on people. William Garman wrote one chapter in Ross Coggins' book, The Gambling Menace. Garman traced the development of gambling from its earliest beginnings among ancient peoples. In ancient China, Japan, Egypt, Persia, Palestine, Greece, Rome, Java, and the Americas, indications of gambling are found. For example, bone dice were in use by the time of Homer. Knuckle bones with numbers on four sides were found in Egyptian excavations dating to the 18th dynasty, in Indian ruins in the southwestern part of the United States, and in later ruins of Pompeii. In England, dice playing dates back to the Roman occupation. The Ice Age had hardly disappeared when crude dice were being used in southern France. A gaming board which was found in Crete dates to between 1800 and 1650 BC. By the 1500s, gambling was used in England as a painless form of taxation. Pages 11 through 13. But since the Bible does not specifically condemn gambling, how can a preacher or anyone else condemn it? There are some scholars who argue that the book of Isaiah does specifically condemn gambling. Let me read the passage they have mentioned. "But you who forsake the Lord, who forget my holy mountain, who set a table for fortune and fill cups for destiny, I will destine you to the sword, and all of you shall bow down to slaughter." Isaiah 65, 11 and 12. Most Old Testament scholars insist that the words fortune and destiny were pagan gods of fate who symbolize good and bad luck. Another reference that some use to condemn gambling would be the casting of lots by the Roman soldiers for the Lord's garments, Matthew 27:35. The actions of the soldiers showed a complete insensitivity to the plight of our Lord. But in the strictest sense, it really was not gambling. So far as the record reveals, the soldiers did not wager anything of value. They simply cast lots to see who would get the garments of Jesus Christ. Casting lots did not necessarily involve gambling. Israelites and Christians used the practice of casting lots to make important decisions. Numbers 26, 52 through 56, and Acts 1:26. Our responsibility demands that we examine biblical principles to determine the rightness or wrongness of gambling. We shall use the remainder of our time today to locate those principles and to apply them to the gambling menace. First, gambling violates the God-given duty of faithful stewardship. Christians have a sacred obligation to take care of their money and other material possessions. God gives us the good health, the opportunities, and the motives for providing financially for ourselves and for our families. Paul argues that if a man does not provide for his own, and especially those of his own house, he hath denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. 1 Timothy 5:8. When we earn an honest living for our families, we have the responsibility to use our earnings wisely and not to waste them through sinful activities such as strong drink, gambling, and drugs. The principle of stewardship is taught throughout the Bible. Our Heavenly Father placed us on this good earth to earn a living by the sweat of our brows. When we earn money, we cannot use it carelessly and expect God to bless us. We are to use our incomes to provide for our families, to pay our taxes, and to give to the cause of Christ as the Lord has prospered us. 1 Corinthians 16:1-2. We need to know that God will hold us accountable for the way we spend our income. To gamble away money which ought to be used for good purposes is gross irresponsibility. Second, gambling not only demonstrates poor stewardship of the Lord's blessings, it often takes control of the gambler in such a way that he becomes addicted to its power. My friends, I do not believe that gambling falls into the category of matters of opinion. But even if it did, in many cases, it would still be a grave evil. Paul wrote as follows to the Corinthians, "All things are lawful unto me, but all things are not expedient. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be brought under the power of any." 1 Corinthians 6:12. There are two ideas in this verse that we need to examine just a little. Lawful and expedient. There are activities which are lawful. That is, they are not condemned by the Scriptures. These normally would be available to Christians. But there could be restrictions placed on the matters of lawfulness. For example, Paul insisted that Christians at Corinth might eat meat which had been sacrificed to idols unless eating would cause a weaker brother to stumble. We are forbidden to sin against a weak brother and wound his conscience. When we so sin, we are sinning against Jesus Christ also. 1 Corinthians 8:12. Wherefore, Paul said, "If meat make my brother to offend, I will eat no flesh while the world standeth, lest I make my brother to offend." 1 Corinthians 8:13. There is also the danger, Paul affirms, that even lawful things might so control a man's life that he would sin against God. Listen again to the Apostle Paul. "All things are lawful for me, but I will not be brought under the power of any." 1 Corinthians 6:12. Let us suppose, just for the sake of argument, that drinking alcoholic beverages and smoking cigarettes are not forbidden by the Scriptures. Nevertheless, for many, if not for most people, they should be opposed because of their addictiveness. Those who take drugs, drink alcohol, and smoke cigarettes are often slaves to these habits. Even if they were not morally wrong, they should be strongly resisted because they make slaves of so many. My friends, the same is true with respect to gambling. I believe that gambling is wrong per se, always wrong, wrong for everybody. But even if it were right for some people, it would be extremely dangerous for those who seem not to be able to handle their gambling. Dr. Edmund Bergler, an American psychiatrist who has specialized in the treatment of gamblers, believes that gambling is addictive. He mentions the Russian writer Dostoevsky as having confessed the great thrill of gambling. These are Dostoevsky's own words. "The main point is the game itself. On my oath, it is not greed for money, despite the fact that I need money badly." I had a young friend in Georgia who confessed his addiction to gambling. He said that he could sit for 24 hours and never get tired of gambling. It became a dominant force in his life. It was ruining his job, destroying his relationship to his wife and children, and badly damaging his reputation in the community. His eyes took on a glassy stare as he talked about the great joys of gambling. You would think, by observing his behavior, that he was talking about some lost love. And he was, the love of gambling. Are you going to allow any activity, good, bad, or indifferent, to gain such an upper hand in your life? Please remember Paul's words, "I will not be brought under the power of any." Third, Jesus taught that we should do unto others as we would have them do unto us. Matthew 7:12. These are not Christ's exact words, but they summarize in a popular form the Lord's statement of the golden rule. Do you want someone, anyone, to take your money without giving you equal value in return. No sane person would argue in such a manner. If you do not want to lose your money without getting value in return, why would you want to take someone else's money in such a fashion? I do not mind spending money for a new car or for clothes or for a house. I try to get my money's worth in every transaction. I honestly believe that I have a sacred obligation to so do. But I do not want to wager a dollar or $1,000 and not get my money's worth. I do not want anyone taking my money and not giving me something of value. The golden rule says that I should treat others as I would want to be treated. Besides, professional gamblers, casinos, paramutual machines, slot machines, and lotteries are arranged to beat you. Your chances of winning in many of these gambling schemes are virtually nil. But the government, or whoever sponsors these activities, will win. They simply cannot lose. How foolish for human beings to gamble when they are going to lose almost every time. If the various gambling schemes were honest, and you had a 50-50 chance of winning, there would be a speedy end to all forms of gambling. Such is not the case. Why cannot intelligent human beings understand the odds in favor of the house? My friends, gambling in many cases amounts to legalized stealing, or in some cases just plain stealing because it is not legal. I knew a man in Georgia who would go to his favorite sporting goods store and buy a rifle or a shotgun. He would then return to his place of employment, sell tickets on that weapon, and award the gun to the lucky person who had the winning ticket. He might spend $40 or $50 and sell $200 of tickets. He would clear $100 to $150 on each transaction. It was against the law because he was neither a school nor a church. In Georgia, only schools, churches, and similar institutions were allowed to gamble legally. This man became quite well-to-do by capitalizing on the weaknesses of others. He was a thief and a lawbreaker, although I'm sure he would have been offended if these terms had been applied to him. So are all those who organize or legalize gambling, whatever their motivation. They are all thieves and robbers. I mentioned the fact that many who organize gambling activities are churches, schools, parent-teacher organizations, and similar groups. Can you fathom the thinking of any such group that would attempt to support their activities by gambling? It may be legal, but it is not moral. I would feel just as guilty, and I would be just as guilty, as if I hired a group of thieves to steal to support the church or the school. Just think of the example to the young people who know of such arrangements. They get the impression, and I can understand why, if the church does it, or if the school does it, it must be honorable. Then they become addicted to wanting to make money without earning it. They get to thinking that the world owes them a living, and they mean to have that living with as little work as possible. How could any church or any school be so blatantly insensitive to the weaknesses of young people, or older people either? Fourth and finally, gambling is evil because it discourages hard work as a means of earning one's living. The scriptures discourage anyone's living off the fat of the land. Paul discussed the duty of Christians to work to earn their upkeep. For yourselves know how you ought to follow us. For we behave not ourselves disorderly among you. Neither did we eat any man's bread for naught, but wrought with labor and travail night and day, that we might not be chargeable to any of you. Not because we have not power, but to make ourselves an example unto you to follow us. For even when we were with you, this we commanded you, that if any should not work, neither should he eat. 2 Thessalonians 3:7-10. Since so many gamblers expect to receive their living without working, you can understand how this scripture so strongly condemns gambling. Work is honorable and God ordained. Gambling is not honorable, and it is God condemned. It is a blight on the home, the church, the community, and the nation. But do I, as a preacher, have a right to condemn gambling? Yes, I not only have the right, I have an obligation. So long as God gives me the strength to speak out, I plan to oppose gambling in every form, from the so-called penny ante stakes to the casinos and state lotteries. They're just different degrees of the same unmitigated evil. Those who support legalized gambling offer a number of arguments to support their cause. The Lord willing, we shall examine those arguments in our discussion next Sunday morning. If you have questions or comments or disagreements, please get in touch with me. We thank you for listening, and may God richly bless you.